If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. My name is Ed Newcomer. I'm your host of Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. Today, our guest is Steve Furr, joining us from his home in Washington State. Steve was a special agent for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, originally stationed in Sacramento, California, but later transferred to a single agent station up in Olympia, Washington. He served many years as a, not just a special agent, but also as a regional and national firearms instructor for the service, which is a great help to all of us agents. And he was the recipient of the very prestigious Guy Bradley Award in, I believe, 2017, right, Steve? Nodding.
That's correct.
The Guy Bradley Award is a recognition of a long career of outstanding service and is named after Guy Bradley, who was the first wildlife officer killed in the line of duty back in 1905. Prior to becoming a Fish and Wildlife Service special agent, Steve served as a wildlife officer for the state of Washington for many years. So I'm super happy to have Steve here. Steve and I worked together in the same region for a number of years, and we know each other quite well. But Steve, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, absolutely, Ed. It's good to be here.
You're looking good. You know, you and I both worked in what was known as Region 1 at the time, which included California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Hawaii, and all of the Pacific Islands. And we always had such a great camaraderie among all of the agents in that region. And I think part of that is because throughout that region, there were a lot of similarities in some of the cases we did, or at least in terms of kind of the high profile of the West Coast in terms of the overall Fish and Wildlife Service mission with regard to law enforcement. So we were always kind of under the same, or we were on the same hot plate in terms of there was a lot of attention on the cases that were handled on the West Coast. I don't know if you, I think you and I share a, we share a mutual acquaintance, a wildlife officer up in the state of Washington named Greg Haw. And Greg said something to me once that really struck me, because I always knew Greg as a very hard charging, you know, uniformed wildlife officer. He was always out there chasing poachers in the middle of the night, working his butt off on weekends and holidays. But he said something to me once that really struck me. And he said, you know, if I could do my career over again and start over, I would have focused a lot more time on habitat cases. And, I agreed with that from my perspective as an agent. I wish I would have. And I don't know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, as a new agent starting out, you know, you're looking for direction on, you know, what to do, right? I mean, what's important? What do they want me to do? And as you know, we had priorities that were spelled out, you know, in the service manual. And you know, if you ever cracked it open and read it, you know, the number one priority was endangered species habitat destruction. So, you know, but they're very unattractive cases. You know, they're always political. You know, nobody likes doing them. Try selling one of those to a U.S. attorney, right? Yeah. There's just all kinds of problems with them. So it was always ironic to me that, you know, it was, you know, this thing first mentioned on levels of priority, but very few of them ever got done. Right. I mean, I think you'd agree with me. I mean, just, there's really just probably been a handful of criminal cases over the years, you know, that have been done on habitat destruction of, you know, endangered species habitat. So,
yeah, that is true. And, in fact, on my way over here to the studio today, I looked up, I went online and I looked at the Office of Law Enforcement webpage for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and I looked for the priorities. And even you know, right now, the priorities for the Office of Law Enforcement, number one, I'll read it to you. I got it here on my phone. It says number one priority is unlawful commercial activities and or activities involving habitat destruction affecting wild populations of fish, wildlife, or plants listed as endangered or threatened. That's like the number one priority for the Office of Law Enforcement. And yet, you're right. I mean, you hardly ever hear about those cases. I think in my whole 20-year career, I worked on less than half a dozen for sure. And of those, I think maybe one of them got prosecuted. And they're complicated to work. They're complicated to explain to a prosecutor or a jury. They are rife with political landmines, right? They can be very controversial because a lot of times they interfere with, you know, quote unquote, private land ownership use and things like that.
Yep, development. And how often do you have bodies, right?
Oh, yes.
That's a key. Most of the time, you know, you're just relying on science and that, you know, these species were there or this is the type of habitat. And, you know, I was lucky on a few of them that it was well documented that, you know, the species was there, you know, and that was really key because, you know, try going to assistant U.S. attorney with, well, we think they're there, you know, I mean, the habitat looks good. So, you know, believe us, they're there and they're just not going to buy that. It's just not clean enough, you know?
Right. And that's where this relationship between the law enforcement side, the agent, and the ecological services side of the Fish and Wildlife Service, where the biologists are, is so critical because, you know, so often they're not even in the same offices most of the time. They're separate offices.
Right.
And they don't communicate very well and very often. And so the biologists, they really have no idea what the agent's going to need when they show up on a habitat destruction case. And if that, if that documentation has been done before, that these animals are there, they were there and they are there and they were there up until this land was destroyed, then you have a much better shot at making a case. But if that documentation is not there, a prosecutor's just going to see reasonable doubt everywhere. Right.
And the service doesn't have the resources to, you know, document every available habitat for all these species. You know, they never will, you know, that just would be a massive undertaking. And some of the hot spots for these species, they have good data and they know where they are and they've detected them over there for years and years. But, you know, a lot of times it's just not there. And there's managers in those offices with those biologists that are leery of you know, getting their people involved in these cases. They know it's going to be a time sucker, right? It's going to just take them away from their duties and you know, you're going to own them for a while because they might need to, you know, write you a take statement or be out there in the field with you. And so, there's just problem after problem with these. They're just not easy, and you really have to have some resolve to push one of these things through.
Yeah, 100%. I have two stories on that really quick. One was, you know, when I was an agent in Southern California, we used to try to go up to the Ecological Services office or at least talk to them on a Zoom call or something and do some training for them on what is it that you need to show to make a criminal case. If a criminal case is ever, you know, in play, the biologists need to know what they need to document and how in order to set you, the agent, up for success, right?
Right.
And then the other one is, to your point about, you know, selling a case to a prosecutor, Agent Aaron Dean and I once worked really hard on a habitat destruction case that involved San Diego fairy shrimp, which are endangered, but you know, they're a tiny little animal that you're not going to find a body. Right.
Yeah, right.
But we actually put together a great case. We actually got a confession from the person who destroyed the habitat, and they admitted that they knew that there were fairy shrimp there.
Yeah.
Took it to a prosecutor with a confession in hand, and we walked into the prosecutor's office, and the first words out of his mouth were, "So what is this, some sort of little mud bug that you were dealing with?" And that just set the whole attitude for the case, and he never prosecuted it. Even with a confession in hand, he would not file charges on that case because it wasn't sexy enough, you know?
Well, and they're misdemeanors, right?
Exactly.
That's the other thing.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you find a false document or obstruction or something like that, you know, it's just, it's a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're busy, right? These aren't, you know, something they're dying to. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, the service wanted us to go civil.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we really didn't have a good civil process. Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't strong in the service, you know. And if we had a real strong civil process, you know, it might have been more attractive because you're going to do all this work like it's a criminal case anyway.
Yeah. I almost never tried to push anything civil because, from my perspective, because the Endangered Species Act maximum penalty is only a Class A misdemeanor, I at least wanted that criminal conviction on the defendant's record, right? Because the punishment for criminal versus civil wasn't going to be that different. It was mainly going to be money.
It's going to
be money. Oh. But I wanted that criminal conviction on their record. So I very rarely went, you know, if I was going to put in the time that you and I are talking about, I went criminal always. And if you couldn't make that, just forget about it. But, you know, when I talk to the public, whenever I talk to, I'm sure this is true for you too, and you tell them that the maximum penalty under the Endangered Species Act is a Class A misdemeanor. Maximum time in jail is 1 year, and what is that, $100,000 fine, I think? It's shocking. You kill the last tiger in the world, and the maximum penalty would be 1 year in jail.
Right.
Anyway, we could go on about that all day. I want to talk to you about a particular area in the Sacramento district where you worked when you were an agent there in Sacramento called the Suisun Marsh. Can you tell us about that? What is it? Where is it?
Yeah, the Suisun Marsh. So I started out in Sacramento. I worked a year there in a RAC office, resident agent in charge. And after that year in the Sacramento office, I decided to take the Burlingame office, which was over in the Bay Area, you know, near the airport there in South San Francisco. And so that was, you know, part of the area I worked was the Suisun Marsh. It was, it's known as the largest, you know, brackish water marsh on the West Coast. Most of it has been diked off to tidal flow. Mm. Originally for grazing and agriculture, but then they turned it into all these duck clubs. And there's literally like 158 duck clubs that are part of the Suisun Marsh. And it's just a bunch of walled off duck ponds to the bay, right? From the bay.
So explain to our listeners who might not be familiar, what is a duck club? What is that for?
Well, a duck club is just usually a group of guys or a family that has gotten together and purchased land. And in the case we're talking about it, they do what they call manage these wetlands. They're called manage wetlands for waterfowl. And they try to raise and lower water levels in order to promote certain types of plants to grow that are conducive to duck, you know, bringing ducks in for hunting.
I see.
And so a lot of this marsh, you got to remember, a lot of this marsh has been diked off for many, many years. And so all the animals and the plants that were associated with a natural marsh, you know, a flowing marsh or a tidal wetlands are, you know, that's been part of the reason there's so many listed species in the San Francisco Bay Area is because a lot of these tidal wetlands have all been drained, diked, you know, for salt production, agriculture, you know, development, whatever. And so very few of these, very little of this tidal marsh remains. I have a couple numbers for you. Yeah. So if you want to get into that a little bit, but historically there were 60,000 acres of tidal wetlands, and now there's less than 8,000.
Wow. Okay.
So that gives you an idea how little tidal wetlands. And a lot of places like up here in the Northwest, you know, we are breaching levees and bringing the tidal flow back in, mostly for salmon, right? And it's the same thing down there. It's, these are really important areas for juvenile salmon, and they're really trying to breach a lot of these levees and bring them back into tidal marshes.
So what, there are certain words that I can never pronounce. This marsh's name is one of them. Even
it's Sassoon.
It's spelled funny. So yeah. There's certain words I cannot say that I will never say on this podcast because I cannot pronounce them.
Sassoon marsh.
So tell us what kind of species are there what this marsh is important to what species?
Yeah, there's a number of listed species, you know, a number of fish, you know, the Delta smelt that's been in the news lately, you know, that's an important one that's just tanked, right. You know, there's, you know, green sturgeon, there's Chinook salmon, California clapper rail, salt marsh harvest mouse, wow. A couple of plants, California lease tern. I mean, I can go on and on. I mean, I think I've probably covered 3/4 of them, but there's probably some I'm missing. So because these are all species that depend on tidal marshes, you know, they've all just really tanked over the years.
And you say listed, you're talking about listed under the Endangered Species Act, like the smelt and the clapper rail for sure.
Yeah, endangered or threatened, you know, one of the two. And, you know, California clapper rails, they used to market hunt those things, you know. I mean, you know, around the turn of the century. I mean, they were going to restaurants in San Francisco. You know, there were, you know, that those kinds of numbers. And some of the stuff I've looked up lately, I mean, they think there's 1,200 of them left.
Yeah. See, so, and that fits perfectly with that number one highest priority for the Office of Law Enforcement. You've got habitat where critically endangered species are living, and that's a high priority.
Yeah.
So you're given that it's a high priority. You arrive in this new duty station. You're under the Sacramento RAC district, but you're there in Burlingame. What? Tell us how'd you get involved with the marsh? What happened?
Well, you know, it's there's some duck hunting that goes on there. It's not like it used to be in the 70s. And a lot of that is because the ducks have shifted, you know, to all the rice in the Central Valley. Right. And so these guys that own these clubs, you know, they're really scratching all the time to try to make things better, you know. And so originally my partner and I at the time, Todd, we started going out and looking at the marsh, just trying to get an idea of, you know, who's who in the zoo, right? And what kind of practices are going on there. And at that point, the way the federal baiting regulations were structured is you couldn't mow anything that had a seed on.
Okay.
You know, it was just prohibited, you know. So all your mowing you had to do before – any kind of seed production, even if it was a native plant, happened with the plant. So there was a lot of mowing going on in the marsh, and, you know, we weren't looking at it as a huge deal, but we were trying to get our a handle around what was going on out there. And if there were guys baiting with outside crops, you know, and that kinds of stuff. And we really weren't even focused, or I wasn't at the time, on endangered species issues because I just newly arrived,
right.
Really didn't know what was happening. So my RAC at the time, the resident agent in charge, he gave me a list of some names of some people to go talk to that, you know, would give me some intel on possibly, you know, who the poachers were, you know, what kinds of bad things were going on. And And of course, you know, I had port duties too, right, you know, with import export, but this was kind of my recreational activity on weekends. And, you know, I'm a hunter, as you know, big duck hunter. So I love the marsh.
Right.
And so one of the people he had top of the list was the executive director for the Sassoon Resource Conservation District, which was, you know, like a water district that was in charge of the Sassoon Marsh and all the duck clubs. And they were the ones that consulted with the Corps and got the Corps permit for all the activities that they want to do in the marsh.
That's the Army Corps of Engineers, right? That controls how those dikes work and all of that. Yeah.
Yep. All the, and so lots of regulations, as you can imagine. Yeah. So SRCD was formed. Sassoon Resource Conservation District is to deal with all the permitting, deal with the 158 duck clubs. Right. Cal Fish and Game has a huge presence there. They have a big wildlife area, Grizzly Island wildlife area.
Okay.
And so SRCD had, you know, a small staff, biologist, and then this executive director that I was, you know, ended up wanting to meet with, you know.
He's introduced to you as a possible, you know, source of great information about what's going on, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, you know, he's going to, you know, I'm going to find out all about, you know, all the bad guys doing bad things in the marsh.
Right.
So we set up an appointment with this individual, and I'm gonna keep his name out of it because there's no reason at this point.
He's deceased. We can talk about him.
So anyway, we decide to go out there, and they actually share, you know, a building with out on the Cal Fish and Game Wildlife Headquarters. You know, there's buildings out there and shops and everything, and we meet with him out in his office. And we start chit-chatting about one thing or the other. And I can tell right away, I'm like, so this is my boss's, you know, good source of information? Because, you know, you're getting the body language automatically, right? That he is not happy with these feds. And he just, you know, he is like, what are these guys up to? Right. You know, a couple of young bucks, you know?
And you're out there.
So we start talking.
You're out there with your partner, Todd Eckhart, right?
Yep. We're out there with Todd. And so we start talking about, you know, marsh practices and who's doing what. And he starts telling us, well, you know, we need to mow out there because, you know, it's really important for water circulation when we flood these ponds, you know, if there's vegetation in the way. Well, prior to that, Todd and I had been out in the marsh and we witnessed this one individual going out with a tractor with a brush hog, you know, a big mower on it. And all he was doing is going from one patch of nut grass to the other, which was this naturally occurring, it's called alkali bulrush or nut grass.
Okay.
And he was going from one big patch to the next, mowing and spreading the seed that this stuff produces, right?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to remember the conversation. So I kind of called bullshit on what he was saying there. You know, I think I said something along the lines of, well, you know, we were watching this guy mow and it looked like all he was doing was going from one patch of nut grass to the other, spreading seed before he flooded it.
Right. Which would be, and, as you described earlier, that essentially is baiting that field to draw ducks in, right?
Yeah, it was back in the day, right? Before they changed the regs, you know. So.
And we had one of my previous guests in an earlier episode was Cass Schrieffer, who worked in Louisiana. He talked a lot about the baiting regulations and why it's illegal. So hopefully people have listened to that episode. They know what baiting is and why it's not legal when you're hunting ducks. But anyway, okay, so you're challenging this guy's statement about the importance of mowing.
And it's important to know that regs have changed. So, you know, native plants, you can do that. But when we were having this discussion, it was still against the regulations.
Okay.
Right. And so, you know, we weren't there to make a huge deal out of it, but you know, as agents, you know, you got to call bullshit on bullshit. Yeah. Right. And so I just mentioned this to him, you know, that what we'd seen, and the guy just got beat red in the face. And I mean, this is the executive director of a government entity, right? And we're on Cal Fish and Game. I'm kind of thinking we're going to form a relationship of some sort here, and it's going to be good. He turned beat red, stood up at his on his desk, or, you know, humped over his desk there, looked me right in the eye, came closer, looked me in the eye, and he says, I'm going to do everything I can to get your ass out of this marsh. This is our first meeting. You know, we're only into this thing 10 minutes, you know. And so I just said, well, I guess we're done here, you know. And Todd's over, you know, just shaking his head. And we just walked out and said, wow, that was something. You know, what have we kicked over?
Exactly.
Here? You know what I mean? Yep.
And, you know, in the detective business, when you run into somebody with that kind of attitude, kind of gives you a clue that there might be some illegal activity afoot, right?
Yeah. And, you know, in hindsight, when we go through the rest of the story, you can see why this guy did what he did. You know, I mean, he was in charge of everything. Suddenly, here come a couple of feds. He knows endangered species are at the top of our list of priorities. At the time, it really didn't even occur to me. I thought this was just like, stay out of our duck clubs, you know, and, you know, we don't want to be worked by you. We're on a state facility. We don't need you out here checking us.
So this is interesting too, because in his role, anytime there's an endangered species and in a habitat, there has to be what's called a habitat conservation plan or an HCP, right?
Yeah.
And this guy, in his role, what was his relationship to the HCP there on the marsh?
Well, you know, he's the keeper of the endangered species, right? I mean, he's the one that's negotiating the permit with the Corps of Engineers for what they can and can't do. He's supposed to be the enforcer, right? Because he signed the Corps permit that allowed everything to happen on that marsh.
So
what dredging was allowed to happen and you know, a whole host of activities out there.
So pretty intimately familiar with what animals are there and what the rules are.
That's all they do. That's all they do. So great knowledge.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, that's what we're going to get, you know, great. It doesn't get any better than that.
It doesn't. So what, after that meeting, now you're kind of, your focus is even maybe more on the marsh. What happens next after that, after the meeting?
Well, what really, you know, so Todd and I, we went out and made some, there was an agent up north in Chico who used to work that area. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know who I'm talking about there. You know, he was involved in one of your cases prior to you being involved.
I think John Mendoza. Yeah.
And so John had some really good contacts there, and he was feeding us information on, you know, some good over limits that were happening out there in the marsh. And I think I'll just tell this story real quick because it was, it's a small group, right? Everybody knows each other. So when somebody gets pinched for an over limit, right, it's going to spread like wildfire. Right. Yeah. And Todd and I sat on an individual, and the information was right on. You know, he's out shooting double limits every day. You know, that's what he does. He kills 14. You know, the limit was 7. He brings half in only, you know, at one time, and then goes out and gets the rest of the birds when the coast is clear. Right. So we watched him the better part of a day kill 14 green-winged teal. Okay. And, you know, we came in by boat. You know, these places are real difficult to get into. The government bought me a great 16-foot lund, and I used to run around those channels, and they couldn't keep you out because there was a lot of channels, and if you knew what you were doing, you could go anywhere.
Right.
And so we came in by boat, watched him kill 14, and what was so amazing to me is he brought his legal limit in. We contacted him where he came into the clubhouse there with 7 birds. We immediately just said, hey, we're not going to beat around the bush. Where's the other 7? We've been out here all day watching you. And he just kind of dropped his head and had me get in the boat with him. I went down the channel back where he came from, where the blind is. And there on this little hummock of ground was the other seven, you know, that he'd put 100 yards away before he came into the clubhouse dock, okay. You know? And my point on this is he'd been doing this so many years that this hummock of ground was just bare, you know, it was just bare dirt that should have been grass because this guy had been doing this for God knows how long. And it just took people to go out there and sit all day to catch them. And who's going to do that? Yep. Right. I mean, it's work. You know, we got up at 0:30, ran a boat, right. You know, through the dark sloughs. So, you know, we were pretty happy, but that, you know, that had a effect on the marsh, right? Pretty soon, all of a sudden there's two feds in there. Yep. They're willing to do this kind of work for an over-limited ox, right? Yep. And so that just kind of added to it. But what got me into the whole endangered species take situation was there was a flood event in the marsh. So this marsh is at the confluence of the Sacramento and the San Joaquin rivers, okay? So they come together right there, huge, huge amount of water. So as you know, when the California gets rain, they get rain,
especially
right?
Up north.
It's usually too much. Yeah, it's usually too much and it all comes at once. And so there was a huge flood event out there in the marsh. And again, these are all duck clubs and there's some nice clubs and there's some reason to be concerned about flooding, obviously. So the Corps kicked out what was called an emergency permit, right? Because some of the levees were starting to fail and there was some holes punched in them. And so the Corps kicked out an emergency permit and that permit said, look, you can go repair the damage, but if there's any endangered species concerns, you need to consult with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service immediately. And then you're going to have to mitigate with them if you end up destroying some habitat, you know, it kind of put the onus on the landowner to get a hold of the service and, you know, fix your problem, but then figure out what to do from there. Right. Well, not all these clubs, but a bunch of the clubs and, of course, the main construction company that dealt with all the construction out there was paid for by the clubs to do the construction. They just went crazy, right? Because they used this as a way to go out and just dredge, baby, dredge, right? Yeah. I mean, they, because they hadn't had access to the kind of dredging for, you know, forever that they wanted to do to shore up these levees. Right. So I get a call eventually from the Sacramento field office, like, it's gone crazy out there. I mean, they're in all this listed species habitat day after day, you know, doing whatever they want because they want to strengthen all these levees under this emergency permit, even and going way above and beyond
right.
what they're supposed to do. So I got called in to the Sacramento office, and essentially my job was to go out and document how much had been done. Right. And so that was going to take up a month or two of my time at that point. You know, it was such a huge amount of dredging all over the marsh. And luckily, you know, they gave me full rein to rent some aircraft.
Wow.
And a lot of it I did by air. I just flew around and took pictures of all this new levee work and doc, because who was going to do
right?
Who was going to keep these guys accountable for the amount of work that was being done?
Exactly.
Right. And so,
like
and of course,
the biologists who contacted you, they could tell these guys, hey, you're damaging habitat and you got no mitigation plan, but the biologists can't force them to stop or do anything else. Right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so really it started out being generated from the Sacramento field office and the biologists that worked out there that knew where all this habitat right. was. They knew the species that were being affected. And so I started the process of documenting all this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were looking at it as a civil case, right? Because, you know, when I started the documentation process, I went into the U.S. Attorney's Office in Sacramento, and they weren't interested in anything that occurred under emergency permit.
Ah, okay.
Right.
Okay.
They just said, hey, we know the language is really good as far as endangered species, and, you know, they can't do this, and they need to get a hold of the service before, and blah, 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 but they just weren't going to touch right. it. So...
Right.
So that's kind of what happened. But there's a lot more to it. And if you want me to go on, I'll continue.
Go on. So you've documented now all the destruction of the habitat. And now what?
Now what? So again, I'm making up these binders. I'm documenting, you know, there's 158 duck clubs. I can't tell you to this day how many were involved in this dredging and this work. There was generally just one construction company that did all the work, a lot of it by barge.
Right.
And so I'm putting together these binders. Well, during the course of this, suddenly there's kind of information trickling in from sources, you know, we're getting calls that, hey, there's a lot more going on and there's a lot of illegal work going on that's not part of this emergency permit and was done prior to the emergency and is being done well after the emergency permit expires. Okay.
So
at that point, yeah,
you gotta go talk to the construction company, right? You're gonna go interview those guys.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, and I knew what the answer was going to be. You know, I mean, this is kind of like it's such a closed group, right? I mean, I can't talk to anybody without, you know, the beans being spilled. So John up north, you know, the agent in Chico, he said, well, if you need help, get a hold of the FBI in Fairfield, California. He goes, there's an agent there I've worked with before on Endangered Species Act cases. He's a great guy, and he'll help you. He's right there in Fairfield, which is, you know, right there on the Sassoon Marsh. And I'm going, okay. So I got a hold of that agent, and we ended up, you know, just becoming really good friends as part of this case and working it together. When I gave him the information on the director of the Sassoon Resource Conservation District, he started saying, well, this guy's got to be up to no good. And, you know, why is he letting this work happen, you know, when he's supposed to be the gatekeeper, right? And so he kind of started looking at it as a public corruption case.
Oh, interesting. Because,
you know, is he?
We've all worked with the FBI in our careers at different times, but it's typically not on a habitat destruction case.
Yeah, right. So, you know, he had a great angle, right? I mean, he had and I was a new agent. I was a fairly new agent. So, you know, he was talking to me about things I didn't even think about, you know, like money and, you know, where are they getting the money to do this and yada, yada, yada. And so I got the FBI involved. And then also, since there was illegal dredging going on, EPA is the one that enforces that, you know, for Rivers and Harbors Act is what it's called when you're doing illegal dredging, you know, and violating a core permit. So I ended up linking up with an EPA agent in Sacramento, super helpful, right? Was totally into it. It was endangered species. She was just gung-ho. And so was this FBI agent.
Nice.
So We kind of started a little task force, and we said, well, you know, if there's dredging outside the emergency permit period, you know, we're going to take these people on a criminal ESA take.
Absolutely.
You know, because they all have the knowledge. They all are part of this core permit. They all have read it. They've all been mailed copies of it. And we're gonna look into it and see what happens. You know,
interesting. And that's another thing. EPA is another agency that has law enforcement authority, and they do have special agents that work for the EPA. So that's another agency that we frequently can get involved in, particularly on habitat destruction or pollution cases and that type of thing. Okay, so so where does this lead you? So now you're definitely on a criminal track. You've gotten good knowledge. You've documented that there's take outside this emergency plan. In the normal course of this investigation, then, where do you go next?
Well, at this point, we're getting some really good informants developed. Okay, they just kind of come out of the woodwork, and we start working with these people closely.
Okay,
right? They're in the know. They start telling us who's doing what, when it's done, how much damage. It's done outside the emergency period. You know, there's full knowledge,
right.
And so guess who pops up as one of the main illegal habitat take suspects in the marsh, but the director of the Sassoon Resource Conservation District.
No kidding. So the informants or the sources you've got start to actually point fingers toward this guy.
Yep, said he did a huge dredge in critical habitat for these endangered species, California clapper rail, Delta smelt, took a lot of habitat, way out, you know, had nothing to do with an emergency. And so this is a guy that's telling other club members or club owners, you can't do this on your club. You know, this is, you know, a violation of the permit. So... And you got to remember, this individual, he's tight with Fish and Game. He's got mucky mucks from Fish and Game hunting his club from the regional office. I mean, it was pretty intimidating. Yeah. You know, you knew there were a lot of powerful people that were not going to be happy with the, you know, the outcome here.
And you're talking about California Department of Fish and Game, which is now California Department of Fish and Wildlife, but... Yeah. So so you've got officials at California Department of Fish and Wildlife who are tight with this guy and actually hunt on his property, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Eesh. Absolutely. You know, regional managers, you know, that kind of thing. And what they knew, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you couldn't know.
Right.
I mean, they're doing these huge projects and floodgates and dredge material and things like that. So, you know, but you know, I couldn't talk to them about it. Again, you know, there was very limited people I could talk to in the know. And if it wasn't for these people that came forward at a lot of risk to them career-wise, right? I mean, these are all people that are in the field, right? And they came through and they gave us some really good information, enough that we eventually wrote a number of search warrants and had about 40 agents from FBI, EPA, and Fish and Wildlife descend on two private homes, SRCD headquarters, the construction company headquarters, and, you know, seize computers and files and everything to document what was going on.
Yeah. So that's when you do a search warrant like that, what are you looking for? Documents mainly or what?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these people, you know, this is, you know, transitioning into computers, right? But a lot of these were paper files, you know, that had a duck club's name and, you know, this is the work that's been done. There was a really interesting twist to this, Ed, and I'm going to bring it up now before I forget about it. It shows you how crazy things get. Well, there's a congressional act called the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, right? And it's NACA. People use the name NACA for this. Well, NACA was a bunch of matching funds to do work on wetlands. And so we have pictures before all this went down of in Ducks Unlimited magazine with our regional director, right, from the Fish and Wildlife Service, standing there with big checks.
Ooh.
And the executive director of SRCD, you know, with these standing with these big fake checks, the service basically giving money to these duck clubs to do work on their property,
which would be habitat restoration work. Supposed to be,
or whatever, yeah. Or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Supposed to be, right?
At one point I was, as you recall, or you brought up earlier, the region was a huge region at the time. And in Sacramento office, I believe they had kind of like a deputy director, you know, somebody that, you know, just handled a lot of the California, Nevada issues,
right.
But you know, it was still run out of Portland, but this person was, you know, right under the director in Portland.
Okay.
And at one point my boss asked me to give a briefing to this guy.
Okay.
Cause as you'll also remember, we were under a different chain of command back
right.
then. You know, the SAC, the special agent in charge, used to report to the director.
Right, exactly.
In the direct up in Portland.
Yeah, the regional director. Whereas now law enforcement has what's called line authority. They go directly to the assistant director for law enforcement in Washington, D.C. Back then,
right.
The special agents in charge for the region answered to the non-law enforcement regional directors for this service. So that was a very awkward situation, particularly in cases like
yeah.
you're describing.
Right. So these guys are going down, giving tons of money to these clubs for their managed wetlands down there.
Right.
And what are they doing with the money,
right.
right? What are they doing with these NACA funds? So I was kind of ordered, more or less, because I was really uncomfortable doing it because it was kind of in the middle of this investigation. And I knew that this deputy manager that was not law enforcement knew all these people I was dealing with at a super high level.
Right.
And so I went to Sacramento like I was told. And I remember a statement that this guy made. He looked at me at one point during my briefing and said, "For God's sakes, please don't tell me there's any NACA funds being used to destroy endangered species habitat." And I said, "We haven't made that connection, but I guarantee it's happening."
Oh boy.
Because you're writing these guys checks and they're spending it any way they want and they're writing their own invoices. And, you know, it'd take a dozen agents to ferret through all this.
Wow.
And so I went to Department of Interior OIG.
Office of Inspector General.
In Sacramento at the time, totally uninterested in the case.
Interesting.
Because I thought, hey, this is right down their alley, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I couldn't get them interested, you know,
yeah.
to work that angle of it. And like, as you know, things get so time consuming,
yeah.
right? I mean, this would have been a whole nother facet to going through books,
yep.
you know, more search warrants, bank records, you know, trying to tie in these checks for NACA funds to, you know, what these guys were actually doing on the ground and whether it was in you know, destroying endangered species habitat.
Right. What's
so
when you did your search warrants, did you do interviews and what was the result of those? Did you get anybody to confess or anything?
Yeah. Well, the timing we did, you know, since we started to have some people on the inside, we actually did the timing. So a couple of the principals were gone,
yeah.
you know, like the, because we wanted, you know, unfettered access to some of the places that we were going. So like the deputy director, I mean, I'm sorry, the executive director for SRCD, he was gone, you know, he was obviously our main target on this thing
right.
because we, you know, we knew he was in charge and he'd violated. So he was gone. So we did interview his deputy during the day of the search warrant. And it was a warm day in this, you know, little bit of a cramped office building out in the middle of the marsh, you know, and boy, we just worked on them and worked on them and worked on them. And, you know, just sweat was pouring out of this guy's forehead. And finally, you know, after a long interview, I kind of took over part of the way through, and it started out with the FBI agent working on him. And then I took over, and we finally got him to admit, yeah, that his boss, the executive director, did a huge illegal dredge in endangered species habitat in the Sassoon Marsh.
Nice.
And this is the guy's name that's on the permit, you know, for the Corps of Engineers, that I will not do any of this stuff, and I'm signing. So
pretty good case at that point.
You know, great knowledge, yeah. Right? Great. It's just, so at that point, you know, I'm like, well, you know, any prosecutor's going to take this.
Right.
I mean, I really felt like, you know, if this isn't knowledge, I mean, I'm just going to give up doing habitat cases if this isn't good enough.
If this right? isn't it, then because, there is no good case, right?
Yeah, there is no good case. I mean, here's the guy that negotiated the permit with the Corps, right?
Okay, so here's the $100,000 question. Did you were able to sell it to a prosecutor? Did you get charges out of this case?
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
what were the charges and what was the outcome?
So we ended up charging through information, you know, misdemeanors. We charged the executive director for the Sassoon Resource Conservation District. We charged him with a take of endangered species and listed, you know, Delta smelt, California clapper rail, and Chinook salmon as the principal species, because it was all habitat outside the levees, you know, that these animals use. Right. And then we also charged the principal contractor, you know, the construction guy, for the same violation. He was in the loop with everybody. He knew all the permit conditions, and they both pled guilty.
So these were criminal charges under the ESA. Great. And they
correct.
Both pled guilty. Okay, good. Do you remember what the outcome was with the sentencing?
You know, we asked for jail time. Of course, we didn't get it. I think they both got $10,000 fines, okay. You know, which, you know, isn't much particularly for the amount of work that went into this. But it was symbolic, yeah. Right? I mean, it was really symbolic. It had a huge ripple effect through the marsh. The board of the SRCD, which is made up of, you know, duck club owners, landowners in the marsh, they terminated him immediately, which I gave him high marks for that. And so he lost his job there. Good articles in the newspaper, Sacramento Bee, and the local Fairfield paper, and was pretty easy to find a number of articles on it for quite a while. Yeah. So.
You know,
again,
I don't know. There's something, this is why I think going the criminal route is so important, because I think I'm sure some of the people listening or watching will say, oh, didn't go to jail, $10,000. That's nothing. But it really is, because at that point, once they pled and they were sentenced, even though it's a Class A misdemeanor, it is a federal crime on their record. Right.
They now
have a record. And
if anybody
ever runs them, they come up as a person convicted of a federal crime. And that has consequences in a lot of different avenues of life. And more importantly, when people might say, gosh, why did that, you know, that agent's work was wasted. He spent so much time doing that case and all they got was a misdemeanor with no time. That's not really the right way to look at it. What you did was, You proved a ongoing, you know, illegal activity. You got convictions. It's on the record. Any future violations of similar, that's where sentences get much harsher in the federal system. The federal system tends to cut people a lot of slack on their first conviction. Second conviction, third conviction, not so much, right? And it can be very, very important to lay that first case down on someone's record, because if they violate again, the penalty is going to be much harsher. They have a much higher chance of going to jail if they are a second offender. And so, you know, it does have a tremendous deterrent effect, even though it's only a Class A misdemeanor with no jail time in this case, right?
No, I agree. I mean, you know, and as you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, they put out real tight press releases that, you know, spell everything out and super easy for the newspapers to pick up and write, and it's all facts, right? It's just, this is what happened. This is what this guy did. You know, he's in charge of this. You know, he thumbed his nose at the Endangered Species Act and was, you know, the major violator. Right. And again, I think of the duck clubs that he denied the same activity, right? I mean, they must have been furious at this because, you know, they're like, what? You know, you're in charge of us and you know, you're violating. Yeah. You know, you're the big violator.
Very selective, you know? Right?
So yeah. So and I did follow up on, you know, we had a gentleman, an attorney that was working out of Portland for a while, and I can't remember his name. He did follow up on quite a few of the civil cases that happened during the emergency permit. Nice. And he got some civil fines from some of the clubs. You know, it was a lot of back and forth negotiation, and you know, they just finally agreed to write a check for X amount, you know, but so that was followed up on, and you know, we did get some justice there too. Nice.
Well, hey, we have about five minutes left, and there's a couple things I want to touch on real quick. You know, when you do a case like this, as you mentioned, there were some, you know, high level people at California Department of Fish and Wildlife who were connected in with some of these clubs. You've got some powerful interests that are looking at this. I think it's important for listeners to understand what the fallout is from a case like this, just in terms of you as an agent trying to do your job. So like, for example, after this happened, I mean, tell us what did it affect your relationship with the state of California Department of Wildlife?
Well, it certainly did with above the warden level. You know, I think the wardens were all kind of, you know, thumbs up, right. You know, because as you know, I mean, the California Fish and Wildlife Wardens, top notch, right?
Yep.
I mean,
very hard workers.
Top notch. I've worked all over the West. I've worked with many state wardens and, you know, Cal Fish and Game at the time, I mean, is what their name was. You know, they were top notch. You could trust any of them with anything.
Yeah, same. It's true in Southern California as well.
But so I think they were all, you know, thumbs up, you know, here's a Fed doing his job and doing stuff that needs to be done. But above that, as far as, you know, anybody above that, I think it was, you know, my name was mud, right? Because I was stirring the pot, you know. Yeah. For sure, in the Napa office, I know, you know, they had the same kind of, you know, organization back right. then, where generally somebody that was in charge was a non-law enforcement person. Right. You know what I mean? The regional manager.
How about from the fish and wildlife biologists? How did they react to your case? How'd they view you?
Oh, hero status, right? You know, yeah. I mean, we're not worthy, you know. I mean, they were... Yeah, it was great. I mean, that was, you know, that was really nice to have that kind of accolades from those guys. I mean, those men and women, you know, they're great scientists. They work really hard. They produce a lot of incredible information. And, you know, they were like, finally somebody's listening.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. So important. I think one of the best things out of this case was, at the time, the special agent in charge for our region was a guy named Dave McMullen. And you told me that after you finished up this case, he gave you a call and he just had three words to say to you. Do you remember what those words were?
Yeah, it was a great case, kid. You know, it was something along those lines. You know, it was just like, you know, he stayed out of it the whole time. I really never heard boo from him, you know. And then I got that call, and you know, when the final report went in and he read it, and he just, yeah, he just said, hey, great case, kid, you know, like, that's, this is what we want our men and women doing, you know.
Fantastic. That was he was a very inspirational leader, and it doesn't surprise me at all that he said that to you.
Yeah, I was real happy, because there was a lot of rocky roads, yeah. Right? You know, there was, you know, in that path was not easy to get to that point.
No, sometimes when you do those habitat cases, you feel like you're really exposed and you're really out there on your own.
Yeah,
I think, you know, yeah. Some of you know, we're going to have an agent on eventually named Sean Mann, and you know, he was doing a habitat case and had a guy draw a gun on him, almost gets in a shootout over a habitat case.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I know. Yeah,
crazy
I know.
Stuff. That yeah. was Northern California as well. Steve, yeah. I know we could talk about this all day. There's a lot more to this case.
Oh, we could.
We've got limited time here, but you also have a ton more stories to tell, and I hope you'll come back on the show in future episodes down the road.
I will.
Good, I will. Because I will force you to do it, even if you didn't want to. So that'll do it for today's episode of Nature Secret Service. I want to thank our guest, Steve Furr. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you being with us today. And we'll see everybody next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.